Truth News Radio Australia on this Thursday, the 12th of August 2010. I'm your host for the night, Herewood Fenton, and with me in the cyber studio is Josh Jackson, in for the show tonight. Welcome. Welcome back.
I love this track.
It's a great track. Are you there, Josh?
I am. It was one of the first I learnt on guitar.
Yeah, Pink Floyd. I hope we don't get sued for using that.
Probably will.
Anyway, welcome to Truth News Radio Australia. And we've got the usual mountain of stuff to cover in the news for tonight. And I'm going to start local, and I'm going to move global very, very swiftly. So please bear with me as we dive into this sea of information. Photographers draw a line in the sand over picture permits. Okay, this is a story from Sydney about the draconian restrictions on photography, which are basically applied to photographers. And there's a distinction here between professional photographers and kind of tourists or people who are taking photos for personal reasons, although in reality the distinction there must get pretty blurry. But it says here that photographers of life on Australia's beaches made Max Dupain famous, but spontaneous images in public spaces are becoming increasingly difficult to capture. Fears about pedophilia and terrorism are largely to blame. If you're an artist and you want to photograph images on beaches, it's impossible. Yeah, I should also distinguish between, say, photographing on beaches and photographing in public spaces like the Opera House. Apparently, on beaches, basically you'll just be harassed by police and even lifeguards. It says here that many photographers, when they go to the beach and they want to do just some general photography, they get treated as if they're pedophiles. And look, there's a combination of things going on here. One of them being that there's this rapacious council fee system where photographers have to pay fees to take commercial photographs that are to be used for commercial purposes. The other is our hysterical, our irrational fear-based view of people who have cameras being pedophiles or terrorists. So I really stress that this is a situation that must be opposed, and the photographers here are actually going to be protesting. And actually, we've put the protest on the We Are Change meetup site. If you go to wearechange.org.au and look at My Meetups, you'll get all the information about the protest, which I believe is scheduled for the 29th of August. So, yeah, I'd really strongly recommend to have a look at that. Now, Josh, have you got any comments on that particular topic?
Well, look, it's been around for years. I mean, I've worked in media organizations my whole working life, and yeah, we're always having to grab grants, and the producers always work very hard to get licensing for this, that, and the other. I've also done some stock photography and stock footage, and a site called iStockPhoto, they sell some stuff of mine, and their terms and conditions are very clear that you cannot upload anything, any building, any landmark, anything, because different councils around the world and different governments are very full on about suing use of images, public images. So, and I remember asking the question, "Oh, look, can I create a 3D version of the Opera House, and then you know, render that photo realistically and upload that. And they said, no way.
How absurd.
So I can't even, you know, because that they could get sued for the likeness being used without a permit.
Yeah. So, I mean, it says here that $1,000 an hour to film Luna Park, or to photograph Luna Park even.
It's like there's no way you could ever make that back easily, you know. So it basically just means you just can't take photos of Luna Park.
And I just want to point out that this may just seem like a bit of red tape, a bit of, you know, some money making going on, a bit of red tape, but it becomes indistinguishable from the kind of restrictions on freedom that we associate with a totalitarian society. And, you know, whatever the cause is, it doesn't really matter because it, you know, walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, right? It begins to become a duck, right?
Yeah.
So of course, the people concerned would say, oh, well, it's not about your freedom. No, we're a free society. Calm down. Don't get over sort of, don't go on with your conspiracy theories. But the fact is that you're treated as a criminal for taking photographs of people at the beach.
Yeah, I wonder how this affects something like Street View of Google's.
Well, of course, that's the opposite extreme of it, where Google is just basically filming everything. And of course, the government has had a snipe at Google over that. But, I mean, basically Google can do pretty well whatever they want.
Do you think it's a bit – I mean, you're capturing light that's bouncing off of an object.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Into some celluloid or now some a chip and capturing a likeness of an object. I mean, it's a perfectly natural, normal thing. And it seems, again, like – because I can't, as a private citizen, say, hey, if you want to take a picture of my car – you're going to have to pay property rights.
Absolutely.
I can't just enforce that.
And look, to merely gaze upon something, you're storing a mental image of it. So again, we just get tied up in ridiculous legal red tape nonsense about the concept of what does it mean to have an image. I mean, and with the coming of nanotechnology, it will be possible to take a photograph by looking at something. It's not going to be that far off before there'll be something you can basically interface with your brain that will allow you to do that.
Well, there's savants that can look at an object,
yeah,
go home and a year later draw it, paint it perfectly to all, to a very much precise detail, and and then sell it as an artwork. I mean,
yeah. It's just this nexus of this kind of rapacious corporatist
taxation
thing, yeah, where they find something they can try to control and then threaten you to demand payment because they somehow have the power to do that, when in fact they don't even really have it. Again, it's color of law type of stuff, but somehow we the sheeple have been just led along to then believe that because a man in a uniform says something that it must be the law. And when we know, Josh, I mean, you and I have looked at so much footage of unlawful arrests and unlawful behavior that we actually know that those men in uniforms often aren't telling the truth when they say, you know, it's the law.
Oh no, they're just costumes to me.
Yeah, they're costumes that make the wearer of the costume believe that he has total power, and they walk around in that mentality, believing, oh yes, I'm in a uniform, I have power, and they will actually say things that actually don't relate to any law or statute. And we saw that in the Toronto G20 protests, where the police were quoting laws that didn't exist.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could go on and on.
Well, yeah, you could.
But there's so much to get through. My goodness. We really, this Twitter feed, I'm just looking over it. It's honestly, it's amazing. The amount of information we have on this Twitter feed, folks, get on it. Truth News Oz is the Twitter account. Befriend it right away because there's just some really good info.
I've been a bit of a tweeting machine, actually, for the past week. I've really been on a high tweet kind of schedule. Anyway, look, let me just move on to the next really – this is – I want to pitch this with a bit of punch. So let me just
– Go. Get Yeah, hit me.
Yeah, okay, here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, the United States is on target to withdraw troops from Iraq. But, and here is the kicker, 50,000 troops are staying behind, but they're not combat troops. You see, the Obama administration made this huge hoo-ha about how they were withdrawing combat troops.
Yeah.
And they've continued to make these you know, backslapping sort of statements about how we fixed Iraq. You know, it's under control because we had the surge, right? And the military, particularly, they're just absolutely in love with themselves over this. You know, we did it, we fixed it, and we show what the Americans can do when the American way is allowed to just ride roughshod over people and just kill people, because we can bring democracy, freedom.
Freedom.
Yeah. And they're withdrawing combat troops. But they're keeping 50,000 troops who actually have all of the same powers and weaponry as so-called combat troops. And the airspace over Baghdad is continually patrolled by American Air Force planes and American Apache helicopters.
Look, folks, the Americans, they've still got troops in Berlin. They've still got troops outside the waters, in Japan, just Korea, Australia. They've got troops everywhere. There's bases, U.S. military bases all around the world. Once they're in, they're in.
That's it. And it's just really important. I really want to blow the myth. I want to explode the myth right now and never have it said to me that the Americans withdrew from Iraq, because it's a complete and total lie. They withdrew a large number of troops, correct, but those troops went to Afghanistan, right? They were just redeployed to another field, another theater of war, as they like to call it, right?
Yeah, theater.
Yeah, theater of war. Isn't it nice, you know? And the Iraqi military leadership is now saying, we don't want the Americans to leave. No, we need the Americans here. Because guess what? The Iraqis don't have any military capacity, because the Americans destroyed it all, right, 7 years ago. And it's never been rebuilt, because the people in charge are just puppets. They're not real. They don't represent the Iraqi people. They were just put there as a prop to make the Americans look like they were creating a democracy. It's so obvious. Okay.
Yeah, but that's the joke of it all, isn't it? It's just so transparent.
It's so ridiculous.
I mean, people openly say it was for the oil.
Oh, yeah.
You know, people openly say it was for domination and you know, the common person, they know all this stuff now. But, you know, I think people are just sort of left in this sort of lurch where they really don't know what to do about it. They just think, well, I've got a mortgage and I've just got to get on with paying my bills.
They do. And I respect that, okay? And all we ask, all I'm asking, right, is that you support us, okay? Because we are trying to, we're building a network of resources here. And the next story I want to cover is exactly, I'm so glad you brought that up, Josh, because the next story I must bring to you is exactly on that theme. Okay, longer term listeners to this show may remember that I wrote an article about 2 years ago for the ABC opinion site Unleashed, abc.net.au/unleashed. It's a very popular site because the ABC commanding so much, you know, kind of kudos amongst the public, is able to get a lot of traffic to that site. And any article that goes on there gets a lot of attention, gets a lot of traffic. But nothing gets more traffic than these really controversial topics like 9/11 or climate change.
Well, your story got the most comments.
For its time, and for the amount of time it was actually open for commenting. I mean, I think the most heavily commented story that I've seen on there was the one written by Joanne Nova about climate change, because she is actually a climate change skeptic, and that story went ballistic, yeah. And it got into thousands of comments, And I didn't quite follow it all the way, but there was a huge amount of fuss and, you know, just furor over that article. Because like 9/11, the climate change issue is incredibly inflammatory.
And complex.
Yeah, inflammatory and complex. And it seems to bring out of the woodwork a lot of what I would call really dodgy operators as well. People who are like your classic forum troll type people on...
But also, you know who else it brings out of the woodwork?
Yeah.
It brings out of the woodwork people that have just been following stuff from the media and they don't really care about the situation, but then they've been drilled for years about something. They just believe it. And then they hear another side of the story. They get so angry
that they suddenly wake up.
Yeah.
And that's what we really care about. That's the reason why we need to get into the mainstream media. Even though we despise the mainstream media on the show, we're always talking about it, how we despise it, but we still want to be in there. We're still resentful. but I mean, because we've got information that needs to get out there. That's all. I mean, they've got an amazing channel to reach people. And of course, their channels are open to those who the controllers allow through.
So what happened on this site?
Okay, I got in touch with Catherine Taylor, who is the editor of the Unleashed Opinion website. She's the new editor. And I got on the phone, I gave her a call, and I brought her up to speed about the fact that I had written the article 2 years ago. And I said, look, Catherine, I believe it's really high time to publish another article, and we've got all this new information, all this new stories from the last year or two. That's things that have happened here in Australia and New Zealand.
Look, you went to town. I mean, it's like a
yeah,
it's a little masterpiece of links and all sorts you wrote.
Absolutely, and I'll quickly run through the letter that I wrote for Catherine. Dear Catherine, further to our conversation, I want to give you a few reasons why I think it's a good time to publish another article on the theme of 9/11 unanswered questions. Firstly, may I draw your attention to an article which I wrote in May of 2008. At the time of writing, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth was still in its infancy. Since then, the number of registered members, all fully qualified architects and engineers, has swelled to over 1,200. These professional men and women have put their careers and reputations on the line in calling for a new subpoena-powered investigation into the collapse of the three office towers on 9/11. In November 2009, I filmed an interview at the Opera House between the founder of AE911truth.org, Richard Gage, and Jan Utzon, which was subsequently picked up by the Fairfax Press. I've got a link there to that. During the same month, Richard Gage spoke at several events in Australia and New Zealand. Mr. Gage received very favourable coverage in New Zealand National Television, which is the equivalent of the ABC in Australia. And you can watch the TVNZ interview, and I've provided a link there. Then we have, in July of 2010, Professor Niels Harrit, lead author of a peer-reviewed scientific paper on explosive residue from the dust of the collapsed towers.
Unchallenged.
Spoke to a capacity crowd in Sydney, and the lecturer was reviewed very favourably again by Professor Keith Suter, a respected Australian academic and member of the Club of Rome, I might add, on 2GB radio, and I provided a link to that. And I provided an excellent interview with Niels Harrit and a summary of some of the key 9/11 truth websites. And I proposed to her, Catherine, I put it to you that questioning the official version of 9/11 has been virtually taboo in our media, and that this in itself is incompatible with democracy and incomprehensible in a country such as ours. It is indeed difficult for me to bring you something new, because I should point out she asked me to provide something new to justify writing the article. So I said here, well, it's hard for me to bring you something new because you haven't, there is so much here, the older material that has never even been canvassed in the mainstream news. And finally, I quote from an
almost like she said, this is all old news, you know, like she really knows all about everything. You could tell she wouldn't even have a clue about any of it.
Indeed.
That there's thermite being found, that there's...
Indeed. And the, just the final, just icing on the cake here, because I like to just juxtapose different facts. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is the only person who has come close to actually going to trial for the 9/11 crimes and who is the professed mastermind of the attacks, is still in Guantanamo without charges. Okay? He hasn't even been charged, ladies and gentlemen, despite the fact that he confessed. He hasn't been charged. Now, why do you think it is he hasn't been charged? Could it have something to do with the fact that he was waterboarded 183 times? Could
it possibly have something to do with that? I don't care. That's what she thinks. That's what she thinks. Oh, I don't know this guy. It's just a brown guy.
Anyway, in response to this passionate letter that I spent, you know, a large part of my day working on, and
I
had
read
great
the massive reply.
I had great optimism for this letter, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. I was positive. I wasn't negative. I wasn't one of these sort of doomsayers, you know, thinking, it'll never go anywhere. I was confident. I felt good. I had a good vibe about it. Okay, I had a vibe, right? Yeah. Now, here's the reply.
Hi, Harold. Many thanks for the pitch, but we will not run a piece on it at this time. Cheers, Catherine.
There we have it, ladies and gentlemen. Now, I'm putting forward a challenge to Truth News listeners. We've got a lot of really great, loyal listeners to this show. Yeah. Okay. Now, I've never asked anything of you before. This time, I'm asking everyone who's listening to this show. Right?
Everyone.
Everyone who respects what we do, right?
That means you, listener.
Indeed, it means you. And what we want you to do, I'm going to put the email address of Catherine Taylor available up on the show notes. And you can send her an email, okay? Now, here is what I suggest, but it's not for me to tell you what to write. I suggest very strongly do not threaten her, okay? Do not write anything that could be construed as a threat. Avoid confrontational language which could be construed as a threat.
But do it all with love.
Do it with love, but tough love, because you do not need to be ashamed of being a truther. You do not need to make her feel good about what she's done. She needs to feel guilty about what she's done. And I'm actually going to read you the reply that I sent to Catherine. And I've had some feedback that this is actually okay. It was worded, you know, in a kind of heated moment when I sat down.
Oh no!
But I've run this past a fairly level-headed person who thinks it's actually okay. So yeah. here's my reply.
Okay, fire away.
Dear Catherine, the brevity of your reply is matched only by my passion and my determination to break your shameful blockade on this subject, using all lawful means at my disposal. To say I am insulted by your response barely scratches the surface. I am merely a messenger from a vast group of decent humanitarian people in this country who you have knowingly denied a voice. Let me be clear. Your organization has betrayed its charter, and we, the people, will hold you to account for that, both personally and collectively.
Too right.
Your job is funded by our taxes, the same taxes which are being used to fund an unjust war based on lies, lies which your organization has propped up from the beginning. Ultimately, this is about the age-old struggle for liberty and human rights, Catherine. Your organization has positioned itself firmly on the side of a brutal, ruthless regime, and you personally have allied yourself with their agenda. How do you sleep at night, really? Yours in truth, Harold Fenton.
Brilliant. Bravo. Bravo. Yes. Yes. Hear, hear.
Yeah. So the challenge is on. The note, the info will be on the show notes. And
look, and honestly, I just want to second what you said there. Please do not threaten. Do not But do everything with peace and love, because you can't fight fire with hatred and fire. You need to fight it with water, and you need to say, look, you know, you need to say, we feel very passionate that this data that's come out, and just give more facts about 9/11. Give more
links. But stick to the best, most conservative facts.
Absolutely.
You know, nothing. Don't even talk about the Pentagon, okay?
No. Talk about Building 7.
And if you're going to say something, make it a quote. Quote from someone, right? Because you're much safer quoting from someone like Niels Harrit or Stephen Jones or David Ray Griffin or something like that. You're much better quoting than trying to. People often get tripped up when they try to launch a little argument like that. So just be careful. But again, it's not for us to tell you what to do. But if you do something and it goes badly wrong, you will completely shaft us. Okay, like if you threaten them, it will totally shaft what we're doing. So you have the power as listener now to help us or hinder us.
Well, we better get on with it. There's more. There's just so much more to be had here.
Yeah, there is. There's a great deal more here. Right. Now, next topic here. Have you got a burning topic that you wanted to bring up, Josh? Because I've got a list here that's.
No, I mean, we really want to talk a bit later on in the show, after the headlines. We're going to talk about net neutrality. And what that means for society, what that means to you and me, what that means to everything, what that even means.
Yeah, we're going to get right into that topic. So let's just mark that question on notice. And I want to talk now about Iran to dump dollar and euro reserves, because I believe this is a really important story, folks.
That's a massive story. I'm not sure if it'll go ahead, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was reported on the Associated Press Wire. Iran has announced plans to get rid of the US dollar and euro reserves in response to the latest UN sanctions over its contested nuclear program. Excuse me. It does say here that they've announced plans, and it could be a bit of rhetoric here on the part of the Iranian government.
They have a lot of rhetoric. Sorry to interject there, but Iran's very well known for this sort of saying stuff that they're going to do and they never really pull through with it. But I wish they do.
Yeah, well, I think what we do know is that Saddam Hussein tried the same trick, I think not long before the invasion, Saddam had announced that he was going to dump the US dollar.
Yeah, that's right. He was going to trade all of his all of the oil in euros.
Yeah, it didn't work out too well for Saddam. Okay, well, but Iran is a very different country to Iraq. Iran 2010. Is a strong country. Iraq 2003 was a country that was already ruined by 10 years of economic sanctions.
Yeah.
So I think, but of course they're trying to ruin Iran. The sanctions that they're trying to bring in on against Iran now will ruin Iran. If they see this puts Iran in a very difficult situation. And I'm not a huge fan of the Iranian government, and I don't want to be seen as sort of being propagandistic in support of Iran, because I know there's a lot of problems with the Iranian government, because the Iranians have never had a chance to have a free democracy because they've been interfered with so much over decades and decades.
Yeah, but it's mainly because of democratic countries that they are so.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
You know, they have democratically elected people who have been overthrown by democracies, namely America, exactly. In the 1950s. We have this constant pushing and pulling underneath the unelected sections of democracies, namely the CIA, and so, you know, it really isn't their fault. And when you see the youth grow up and they start to rebel against their own governments anyway, they start against any sort of oppression, they start to break away from this sort of anti-American sentiment, of this anti-free market sentiment, and they start to go into it. Now that America's pushing again, they're turning all these people that were, you know, freely creating democracy anyway, naturally, or creating more freedom, creating them, turning them back into more of a what their parents used to be.
Yeah. So, look, just briefly, just to summarize, the situation with Iran is incredibly serious. And I've put an article on the show last week by Michelle Chosadovsky highlighting the fact that the flashpoint, we're reaching the flashpoint here. And it's been building up for years. A lot of people are probably sick of hearing about it, but it's been building up to it. They've been leading us into it. And this is coming synchronously with an economic collapse, the stage two of the financial collapse. And it's really important to point out here that the 2008 stock market collapse, the pattern here is that it takes a couple of years for the real recession or depression to kick in when a massive stock market crash occurs, as happened in 2008. And I was just having a look today at the 1987 stock market crash. You know, the recession didn't kick in until about 3 years later.
Yeah, and they didn't even have, measurements to bump it up and make it grow. They let it
deflate more. And what we've seen in Australia is just this so much massive government throwing money at everyone that yeah. That plus massive immigration in the same year. Like we had something like 300,000 people enter the country in 1 year, which of course artificially boosted the economy. Now we escaped the economic downturn, but the America's going into stage two, the double dip, right? All the pundits are saying it. Now that is a massive trigger for war. And I was also looking at what happened in the year 2000 in the lead up to September 11. The same thing happened. There was the stock market had reached an all-time high around about the end of 1999, beginning of 2000. The stock market reached an all-time high. Then there were all these kind of jittery things that started to happen. There started to be this slide. There was the beginning of the dot-com collapse. And that whole year, everything was in a slide. And I remember at the time, I don't know if you remember, Josh, but there were a lot of doomsayers then saying that we are in for a big depression. They were saying that then before September 11. It's really interesting. If you go and have a look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average and you look at what happened after the 9/11 attack, first of all, there was a drop in stocks and shares immediately after the attacks. But it bottomed out really quickly. And then from about the end of 2001 onwards, it hit bottom. And then it started to climb. And then in the lead up to the Iraq invasion, it started to really climb. And then 2003 with the invasion, 2004, 2005, the American occupation of Iraq, you can just watch it. It matches perfectly. It's the best indicator I've seen that whole war was tied to economic motives, monetary motives.
Well, Smedla Butley put it right. War is a racket.
Absolutely.
And, it's a really good little piece of writing. You can look it up on the net, but it explains that whole thing that you just talked about there.
Highly recommended. Okay, moving right along, we have some other pretty interesting stuff over here. Let's just have a quick recap on the internet filter, because there's been a lot of toing and froing here between the Labor and Liberal over whether we're going to have internet censorship. And the latest story out from Fairfax Media says Labor is steadfast over their internet filter. I mean, this is actually from the ABC News. I mean, this is quite staggering, really, when you think of the amount of pushback that they're getting from all sides. And yet they say here, Labor announced its filter plan and intends to go ahead with it. And the coalition announced it would ditch the filter and instead spend $60 million on providing internet filtering technology. Yet the Labor
two
Party...
Two families.
Yeah, two families.
Which already exists anyway. See, this is more spending. This is more grabbing money from productive citizens who could be creating businesses and creating jobs and giving giving you back your money in a way that's totally useless, like some crap filter that they're going to give you to stick on your computer. When you can get an open source filter right now for free that's developed by the internet, by the community. I mean, do you really think the government knows anything about the internet? No, they don't know anything.
Yeah, that's...
It's absolutely absurd. And it's, again, just another scam, another way of making you think that you just absolutely need to vote them in.
Correct, correct. Okay.
I mean, it's better than a filter that's controlled by the government, you know, absolutely. But it's still a waste of money.
Absolutely. Okay, what else have we got here that's particularly pressing? Let me just have a quick...
But might I just quickly add...
Yeah, please, go right story, ahead.
...is that the internet filter, folks, I just got to remind you, now, the story isn't over with that, because the internet is not a threat to the Labour Party. It is not a threat to the Liberal Party. It is not a threat to a single party. It's a threat to the system, the political system, because it lets you and I have a conversation about them that can go viral and spread information about them. It's very dangerous for a top-down, centralized, managed information control grid. It's very dangerous for that because they do not have control. So when Liberal come in and say, the internet filter's scrapped, at election time, boom. You never, ever believe them, because I can guarantee you if Howard got in instead of Rudd in 07, Liberals would have been pushing ahead with a filter. Because I remember there was talk about a filter back then.
Very true, very true. And there's a good chance that the Liberal government, if it does get elected, will bring in a version of the filter. And I should also point out that already what we've seen is the carriers, Telstra, is now actually saying that it's going to block child porn. I'm totally okay with that, right? Don't get me wrong. It's fine if they block child porn, but I'm still concerned about how they're going to make the determination. Who makes those decisions about what gets blocked, and what if they make a mistake? Because basically, there is a problem here. There's an ongoing problem.
I mean, this whole thing leads into net neutrality. So let's talk about this further later if you want, or do you want to continue?
No, let's bring this into the net neutrality debate, because I do believe it is
okay. Well, let me first start with this.
Relevant, certainly.
We'll continue with this. That if Telstra and that they talk about this voluntary filtering thing, the reason why I don't think this is going to happen, and they can say it's going to happen, but it opens up all of our telcos to massive suing and legal problems, because as soon as they start dipping into the data that's in the pipes, as soon as they've got their fingerprints on it, they are then liable for information. So if someone's child is sitting there at home and comes across something, or someone just in general anyway, and says, I was that offended, then all of a sudden Telstra is liable for the shock that you might get from seeing such horrific content. So I think to shield them, they'll either ask for immunity from being sued, like the pharmaceuticals have with inoculations, or they just won't do it anyway. And right, they'll leave it up to the police service, which it should be left up to actually hunt down these sickos that create this disgusting content.
Yeah, look, that's a really good argument, I think, Josh, and it certainly it speaks to this whole question of allowing the market to be driven by what the market wants, but by what, which is the people, you know, allowing the people to drive the market. I think that the only problem there is that you do have to allow competition to exist. If you don't allow competition to exist, or to flip it the other way around, if you allow giant monopolies to get control, then how is the market ever going to operate properly? And this is where the question of regulation again seems to be the only solution that, that a lot of, you know, fairly rational people have been able to come up with
as to how regulation, we preserve
competition.
Now, and I see where they're coming from. And at first glance, you think, oh, yeah, regulation, that works well. But who has the power to lobby the government? Do you think it's little old Bob who wants to start his who wants to start some ISP, or that is not getting, wants to get through the net? No, it's going to be these big corporations that enforce more monopoly, and monopolies are usually put in place by regulation. The regulation laws are usually written up by companies that have vested interests in building or keeping duopolies or monopolies or triopolies, like, you know, closed loop monopolies.
Yeah.
And you find this over and over again, where these because at the end of the day, governments don't really have a clue about anything, right? I mean, it always surprises me when you think, oh, you know, a doctor has to study for, you know, 10 years to become a doctor, but then some nitwit can become a congressman who hasn't studied anything and then can write laws and basically regulate the whole health industry when they haven't got a clue about health. I mean, you know, it's the same with the internet. I mean, literally, if you talk to anyone in politics, I can guarantee 80 to 85 to 90 to 95% wouldn't know what net neutrality is.
Correct. Look, at this point, let's just take a break because we want to get into the net neutrality question and we want to actually explain it all, walk you through it. I'm going to play a song here and we're going to get straight into net neutrality. So please stand by.
A story about a ghost come back from out in the sea, come to take his bride away from the house carpenter. Where I met my own true love, where I met cried she, I've just returned from the salt sea, and it's all for the love of thee. I could have married a king's daughter there, she would have married me, but I have forsaken my king's daughter there, and it's all for the love of thee. Well, if you could have married a king's daughter there, I'm sure you're the one to blame, for I am married to a house carpenter, and I'm sure he's a fine young man. Forsake your house carpenter, and come away with me. I'll take you to where the green grass grows on the shores of sunny Italy. So up she picked her babies three, and give them kisses one, two, three, saying, take good care of your daddy while I'm gone, and keep him good company. Well, they were sailing about 2 weeks I'm sure it was not the three. When the younger of the girls, she came on deck saying, what's company? Well, are you weeping for your house and home? Or are you weeping for your bee? Well, I'm not weeping for my house, carpenter. I'm weeping for my babies three. Oh, what are those hills yonder, my love? They look as white as snow. Those are the hills of heaven, my love, for you and I'll never know. Oh, what are those hills yonder, my love? They look as dark as night. Those are the hills of hellfire, my love. Well, you and I will unite. Oh, twice around with the galley ship, I'm sure it was not three. When the ship all of a sudden it sprung a leak and it drifted to the bottom of the sea.
Sick of the propaganda, when you're over the disinformation, when you can't stand the deception, when the deceit gets too much, when the spin becomes transparent, you know where to turn. You turn on truthnews.com.au with your hosts, Harold Fenton and Joshua Jackson.
Welcome back. It was a song there sung by Bob Dylan, circa 1963, The House Carpenter.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I like that sort of bluegrass sound. Bluegrass guitar.
Indeed. By the way, the Bob Dylan song that I put up on the 9/11 Oz YouTube channel after I discovered that all the Bob Dylan had been taken down is still there. I put a special plea on behalf of humanity. I said, please don't take this down. And they still haven't taken it down. Its views has climbed up to about 8,000 at this point. They tend to really go ballistic, those Dylan videos.
Yeah.
And then it tends to get higher and higher on the trends, and it comes up in the top of all the searches. And then, of course, the views go higher and higher. And then that's when they take it down. Anyway, it's funny. Anyway, I like Bob Dylan. Okay.
Oh, I didn't notice. So, net neutrality. Let's break it down for the folks at home.
Let's break it down. Let's break it down.
As far as I can see it, came from the BitTorrent ideal. So BitTorrent, for the folks at home, is basically came from, if anyone remembers Napster, Napster developed a way to share music files. So when you uploaded, when you had your MP3s on your computer, you logged onto a server. You pointed to a folder on your computer and said, here's all my songs. The server took an index of your songs and it took an index of everyone else's songs. You searched for Bob Dylan and they said, hey, that computer over there's got Bob Dylan song that you're after. And basically connected your computer to his computer or her computer and you started downloading. And that's called sharing. And you downloaded a copy of that song. Now, Napster got shut down and instantly millions of others propped up and they were getting subsequently sued. And then other people started developing new concepts around that and BitTorrent was born. BitTorrent basically lets you share folders. So all of a sudden you could share whole albums. and movies, and now a lot of data started happening. So, you know, and you know, I don't want to pay out. I don't want to, you know, say the wrong things or anger anyone. But let's be honest. Most of BitTorrent, you know, 90% of it is illegal content. Now, when I say illegal, I'm not the biggest fan of intellectual property rights as in the current system as they are. But the guys at Comcast and the major ISPs, that's how they see it as illegal content. And so a lot of their traffic is being taken up by this illegal content coming through their servers. Now, somewhere along the line, someone would have come along and given the head of some executive a piece of paper saying, hey, you know, 70% of the content on our bandwidth that we've paid for and we've bought all this equipment and stuff is being used by 10% of the people, 20% of the people, 30% of the people of our subscribers, our users, for downloading this illegal content. So, I mean, first of all, you got to think, well, right, what are we going to do about it? You know, what if 20% of the people, if you're taking too much of your slice of the pizza that's on the table, something's got to give, something's got to happen, someone's got to pay. And that's what net neutrality. Now, net neutrality is there's been laws in place, or there's been sort of this unwritten law saying, hey, everyone's allowed into all of the content all of the time. So what the ISPs are saying, hey, well, let's throttle down the speed of BitTorrent traffic and allow you know, everything else or whatever they want to do, you know. Now, people that are proponents of net neutrality are basically saying, hey, don't you dare throttle anything, because if you do that, you'll let, you know, ISPs say, oh, look, this ISP is building their own YouTube, so we're going to throttle YouTube. So if you then use that ISP, then all your YouTube will go down, won't be very fast, you'll take ages to load, and then... others are saying, well, then other traffic will go really slow to smaller sites and stuff like that. Now, correct me if I'm wrong here, Herod, but
can I just add to what you've said, because you've highlighted one of the kind of core issues within the net neutrality debate, but I want to just give a more macro view of it, right?
Good.
Because basically what net neutrality means as a concept, and a lot of listeners might not actually have heard this, right? What it means is that you, as, for example, joshjackson.com, you could set up your own website, joshjackson.com, right?
Yeah.
And you could put your blog on there, right? And News Limited has, you know, news.com.au, right?
Mm.
And you and newslimited.com, in terms of the data that you stream out from your node on the internet, get exactly the same bandwidth, exactly the same treatment. The companies that command vast resources and power and money do not get their data transmitted through the pipe, as it were, any faster than your data. They have other ways of improving their performance. They use things like networked caching, and they've got very fast servers, etc. And that's all stuff that they pay for. And they
sprinkle servers all over the place, copies of these caches, so that
indeed. And that's
edge servers.
That doesn't affect net neutrality, because when we talk about net neutrality, we're talking about the pipes that the data travels through. And the best thing to compare it to is like electricity. For example, when you plug an appliance into your PowerPoint at home, you and, say, a giant, you know, organization of thousands of people get the same treatment from the electricity grid. The electricity doesn't favour any one institution or any one kind of node on the network. It just basically, as soon as you plug into it, you get whatever's on the grid, right? Mm. And it's the grid that's maintained in such a way to make sure that everyone gets equal access to the electricity. But of course, you pay for what you use. So it's not like a free for all. It's not just like you get free energy. We're certainly not proposing that with the internet. The net neutrality people are not saying it should be free. They're saying, yes, if you want to draw more information, you should have to pay for it. But what they're saying is that the pipe shouldn't be constricted so that certain people get fast flow through while other people get a trickle.
Well, the big thing is that, Comcast will team up with Google and only allow, Google content and not Yahoo anymore. And then the macro thing that you said, and all the smaller blogs won't get access. But people may hate me for this. People may, because, I sort of differ from a lot of people of like, yeah, we need regulation on this. We need net neutrality to be enforced in law, enshrined. But once something becomes in law, a law basically means you start pointing guns at people.
Correct.
Because it means it is now enforced by force instead of a free market solution. Now, I'm a big free marketeer, as you all know.
Here's the problem, if I can just interject briefly.
Yeah, sure.
The problem here is, Josh, that organizations like Verizon and Comcast, they own the pipes.
Well, not really, because, Cisco build the routers and stuff. Now, it's a very expensive thing to set up your own ISP, for sure. And in that way, it is kind of a duopoly, it's a very small niche of people that can actually deliver the enterprise because it's such an expensive enterprise to set up. But saying that, I don't think by law there's no monopoly, So if someone had the want to or the means to, they could.
In Australia, by comparison, Telstra owns the infrastructure. They are the carrier.
Why? Because it was government created.
Yeah, it was government created, and then Telstra became privatized, and basically, they've said, there's just one set of wires, but of course, everyone has to have access to it, and they had to give Optus access to the wires. Optus was the first competitor that was allowed into the market. Mm. Now there are quite a few others. But just getting back to this question of keeping the channels open so that you don't get a two-tiered system. You don't get like a fast lane for organizations.
If a company's going to come up to me and say, look, or if someone says, look, I only use YouTube and I use Google and I don't really want anything else, why shouldn't I have the choice from my ISP to say, hey, well, you're going to get a faster thing, plus you'll pay less because I'm going to only deliver you that? But the problem, and this is where I think net neutrality will win out anyway, because people, A, they don't want people messing with their internet. They don't want people filtering out stuff. The general person just wants to have access to the entire net. And B, it comes back to companies being liable. As soon as companies start filtering out content and then one bit of content gets through that part that they weren't expecting, or someone comes across some porn or something like that, some old lady, they start suing. And that's why companies, I think, will be very standoffish because the internet is just a whole heap of pipes. There's a whole heap of crap coming through a pipe. And as soon as companies say, oh, we're going to filter this for you, A, it becomes a very, very, very hard thing to do, and B, becomes very expensive. But I think in terms of voluntarily, I mean, from where I'm – and you might have a different take on this, Herod, but from my money is if someone says, look, I don't use BitTorrent, I don't know what eDonkey is, I don't know what Kazaa is, I don't know what any of that is, I never use it, I just go on there to check my email – because at the end of the day, someone has to pay for this download. Because the big internet companies have to expand; they have to get more equipment for the amount of data that's moving through. So, either you pay with time, by stuff taking longer to download, or you pay with money. Or there's, you know, look, or there's, hey, you can have access to the whole net over here if you want to pay more, which means
there's
you can
a big
have
difference
here.
If I can just say.
Can do that. And most people will just choose more. I can be pretty much guaranteed that most people say, look, I want the whole net.
But is it, if I can just say that there's a big difference between what you're saying and the real threat of what a two-tiered system would mean. You're talking here about a situation where, as a consumer, I might opt to have a slower connection because it's cheaper. That already exists. I mean, you can choose to have a modem connection instead of broadband, and you can choose to have like fast broadband or slower broadband, and you can choose to have like wireless, which is actually slower than broadband. So there's already actually quite a few different choices you can make that each have a different price associated with it.
But they're not slower because they're, you know, it hasn't got a whole heap of traffic
there's various reasons why they're slow. I mean, modem is the slowest and it's also the oldest. It's the oldest technology, the dial-up modem, right?
Yeah, but it's not slow because there's a whole heap of content going through it, like video and...
Well, it wasn't forced to be slow. It is slow because that was the first technology that was developed, and it's not as advanced as other technologies. But it doesn't, as you quite rightly say, it doesn't get slowed down by the way people are using it. It's just a slower technology.
Okay. That's right.
But I just want to point out that there's a big difference between all that and a two-tiered system where you as a ISP, not an internet service provider, but you as an internet node. In other words, you as a webmaster of a website that sits on the internet, which ultimately is something that's running on a computer somewhere that's plugged into the internet. You are fed into the stream without privilege, right? It's not so much about the end users pulling, it's about the push end of it getting equal treatment from the network. Because we know that individual consumers are always going to have different speeds based on their equipment, even based on the computer they're using, it's going to be slower or faster. But that's not the point. The point here is the information that's coming from the web server that sits on an internet network that the internet network doesn't say, oh, well, you're running off network XJC45, which is actually a B-class network. Therefore, we're going to sort of reroute you through this slower channel. So all of your customers, no matter who they are, no matter what they've got, whether they're using broadband, wireless, modem, will get a degraded performance because of a two-tiered system.
It just wouldn't happen. I mean, you've got massive amounts of money. You've got, you know, the major amount of money that Google makes is from people's little blogs, people's little websites. It makes its money from having vast networks of little tiny sites. And I think, you know,
correct.
Also huge data centers. I mean, you've got, you know, what's the one, you know, there's hundreds of these massive data centers.
Sure.
They're not going to take that line down. They're not going to say, hey, no, they're going to want a piece of the pie. They're going to want faster systems. And what will happen? Someone else will come in with a system and say, well, actually, we're just building another network here that's going to plug into that because we're just going to route around this. And that's the resilience of the internet is so huge.
It's resilient. Yeah.
And what I'm worried about is if we start lobbying all our governments to say we want laws enshrining something, what happens then is there's these unseen circumstances, unseen things that happen because of that. So all of a sudden, then you need policing to police the net neutrality. Is everyone neutral? Then you'll get lobbyists from these huge companies that didn't want net neutrality. Of course, they're going to then use the laws to lobby, the whole net neutrality thing in their favor somehow. I mean, I can't come up with all the amazing, crazy ways the market tries to get around this sort of. The violence of the state enforcing enforcing things that the market doesn't want. I mean, at the end of the day, if the internet's packed full of millions of people downloading huge, vast amounts of data, but there's this, and I see what you mean, there's a server side of stuff, but the server side would be the same as the end user, really. I mean, it's the same thing. You're a user on the internet, whether you're putting information out there or you're taking information.
As a webmaster, you are a user of the web infrastructure, of the internet infrastructure that is provided through, as you say, a data center or a colocation.
Yeah, the data center. I mean, imagine the data center saying, our data center is not that good. It's not first class. I mean, the first thing they're going to say is, we run on the fastest pipe.
Well, that's right. Look, can I just backtrack a bit? Because I feel like we started this story at the end because we've kind of gone backwards through it. But we should have started by launching with the main story, which kicked this all off. I'm just going to read to you here the story about Google and Verizon.
Yeah.
Because this is actually why we're talking about this right now. Google and Verizon near deal on web pay tiers. And this was published on the 4th of August. This is from NewYorkTimes.com. Google and Verizon, two leading players in internet service and content, are nearing an agreement that could allow Verizon to speed some online content to internet users more quickly if the content's creators are willing to pay for the privilege. The charges could be paid by companies like YouTube, owned by Google, for example, to Verizon, one of the nation's leading internet service providers, to ensure that its content received priority as it made its way to consumers. The agreement could eventually lead to higher charges for internet users. Such an agreement could...
Well, hang on, stop right there, because that's not true. Because what happens is there's a subsidy being paid by Google to Verizon, so consumers will be actually paying less. Because when companies start subsidizing stuff to get it through, plus, I mean, let's look at Apple and AT&T. Now, they've got a pipe in a way because they're saying, hey, AT&T is not allowed to have Skype running over the 3G network.
Right.
So that's off. You're not allowed to, but you're allowed to on Wi-Fi. So there you go. There's a system. Now, what are consumers doing? They're buying the iPhone because the iPhone's such a shit, such a really hot, hot thing, because it's a really nice tool. But they're getting a lot of people. In fact, the Google phone is outgrowing the iPhone by like twice as fast now.
And this is because Apple has blocked Skype on the iPhone. Is that right?
Well, not just that one single reason, but because it's a closed system.
Yeah.
And people don't like closed systems, so they go elsewhere and competition finds it. And the free market says, hey, there's a niche here. All these people, that Verizon and Google have got this tight-knit thing. And people are like, well, I'm not getting fast. You know, what's the next hot thing that comes along, Facebook or... You know, like Facebook or some other thing that's unbeknown to us now, and people are going to be like, "Well, why am I on this crappy network that doesn't allow that through? Because they've got some agreement not to allow other stuff as fast." I mean, people just end stuff through. And now, what happens if you get the government involved, which wouldn't have a clue about the internet? You start enshrining more of this fascistic corporatism, this sort of government. Slash corporate collusion. And I know it sounds crazy because what they're trying to say is, hey, we're enshrining the non-collusion of free market plus... Oh, what am I trying to say? It's a difficult thing to say, but
yeah.
But basically what I'm saying is consumers do not want to be restricted, and they will find any sort of... executive with half a wit about him will go, well, this is silly. Our consumers are saying we want everything and we want everything fast. We don't want some things fast, but some consumers do. So there'll be a niche because some consumers might want to pay less for their internet, but because they only use YouTube and Google Mail, they're going to go for that plan because, hey, I don't use anything else.
It could be true. Can I just, at this point, I'd like to play a short clip that I found from a net neutrality activist who I think articulates the view that you're kind of disputing.
Yeah.
I thought he was pretty articulate about it. So let me just play it, and you can interject as you wish.
As some of you may know, the United States government's FCC has been looking into ways of implementing laws to protect net neutrality and to protect the principle of openness that allows everyone to start websites, to start services that may become as huge as YouTube. It's this principle that has enabled so much growth on the internet and that has allowed anyone with a bright idea that could change the world to actually make a huge difference. Because unlike television on the internet, you don't have to pay for every broadcast to get your name and your show and your commercials on their station. And if you can pay for some web hosting and some bandwidth, everyone can access your service. A net neutrality law would protect this principle of openness. It would make sure that internet service providers like AT&T would not be allowed to discriminate, to say, well, we're gonna speed up your access to YouTube, but we're gonna slow down your access to Vimeo because we have a deal with Google and therefore we allow you fast access to their sites, but we will slow down access to all other video sites. Proper net neutrality legislations would prohibit this kind of thing and would make sure that the internet remains the open playground for innovation and competitiveness that it is today. Google.
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Now, I mean, can you imagine how PO'd a consumer would be if some viral video gets sent to you and it comes up on Vimeo and you can't watch it because you're with some idiot ISP who's slowing that down? I mean,
yeah.
You would just drop that ISP as fast as pie. I can guarantee you would not be with that ISP. The whole notion of the internet is to try and get as fast as possible.
Well, if it were that easy to switch ISPs, I would have switched ISPs a few times just to try out a few ones. I tend to find once you're on with one, and they often lock you into contracts as well. I mean, the same thing happens with mobile phones, by the way, too. I recently got locked into a contract with Telstra that I absolutely hate.
Yeah, but no one forced you into it, right? I mean,
I was talked into it by a girl in the shop. Because I didn't really want to change networks, and she said, "Oh, you can easily get out of it." Well, it turns out it's really hard to get out of it. I'm just giving you an example there of it. It's not actually, with mobile phones, it's actually quite. And when you want to switch your mobile phone network provider, they actually disable your entire account for up to 24 hours, which means anyone who tries to call you during that period just gets nothing. Quite frightening.
I've moved house, right, just recently, and I know what you mean, because moving house is the same deal. You're cut off the internet for 2 weeks. But there's things you can do. I mean, you can literally go out today and you buy a little USB wireless modem that works over the 3G network. It'll cost you $40. It's prepaid.
Yeah, I got
one of
those.
No contract.
Yeah.
And I bought that in the meantime while I was transferring over. And you know, I never use ISP emails, so I'm not locked into that because I use a Google Mail or a Yahoo or something
sure.
that's
you use your own mail server or
your own mail server, away from the ISP, so you're not locked into that.
Indeed.
And away you go. I mean, it's not really that hard. I mean, and I've never been in a contract with my internet. I've always just gone, no, I don't want a contract because I've got my own modem. I've got my own thing, and I'm just paying month by month. And you know, they'll try to make it cheaper. They'll say, "Oh, well, it's $10 cheaper a month if you go on a 24-month contract." And I say, "No, I don't want it because I don't know what I'm going to do." And but some people might want to be locked in. But yeah, I mean, it's not easy. But at the end of the day, I would much rather have a voluntary approach to life than having me saying, "Oh, I want the minority congressman there to throw, to be pointing guns at people by enforcing laws." And now, the reason I say that is because who really has the power once a law is passed? It's not me. It's not me. I don't have the resources to go lobby the government. It's these multi-million-dollar corporations that do. So once something is in law, it's not me that has the say.
Yeah.
Okay, but keep on going.
Okay, yeah, well, let's keep playing this video, okay.
Has probably been the most important big multinational to always stand up for net neutrality and give proper feedback to government organizations such as the FCC so that they are well informed about these matters. Google has now made a formal official suggestion to the FCC of what their vision is of a net neutrality legislation. What it comes down to is that their suggestion for a net neutrality legislation is something that would be beneficial and profitable for them, but would be no guarantee for net neutrality and would be a major step back. They're using very vague terminology, such as saying, as long as the discrimination is not meaningful, it's okay. And they're even saying that net neutrality cannot be applied to wireless internet because there are too many technical limitations and there has to be discrimination in this area. This is a very dangerous suggestion because wireless is the future. In 5 or 10 years from now, we will all be using the internet far more on our smartphones and tablets and laptops wirelessly than via our trusty old ethernet cables. It's perfectly understandable for internet service providers like AT&T and Verizon to say that they need a certain measure of traffic management to make sure that their networks do not get overloaded. And while none of us particularly enjoy bandwidth caps, this is a fair way of doing this. Your telephone company may charge you by the minute for international calls, but they do not tell you who you are allowed to call and who you cannot reach at the same quality. They do not restrict your access. If there is a problem both in the wired and the wireless space with the amount of traffic, bandwidth caps are a fair way of managing this. There's no need to block or slow down certain sites or services. It's a very logical commercial move for Google because...
Okay, I just want to point out one thing. When we talk about net neutrality in the way this guy is referring to it, you see, there is a fear that they will deliberately create a two-tiered system, and of course you're saying, Josh, well, the market will correct that because people will actually choose internet suppliers, service providers that give them what they want. Okay,
no one wants their content to be messed.
But that's your position on this. However, I believe that. Historically, it has been quite possible for a two-tiered system to exist, and it's only with the recent advances that we've seen in technology with the internet that, for example, media can now be, you know, you can set up a blog, right?
Yeah.
Truth News is a perfect example of it. On a shoestring. And we've got the same capacity to reach people, to influence people, as the biggest corporate multinational website, news website out there. Because,
absolutely.
But yeah. It really does rely on the fact that information can flow through the pipe. If the Truth News feeds were slowed right down and you couldn't play the audio properly
but
and all this stuff,
what are you saying?
You know, it would be very different, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
very
but different. That's like saying, you know, people, the guy's basically saying, look, what about the people that can't afford, you know, a contract with an ISP that allows the whole net freely like it is and can only afford the one that's, because broadband is standard now. Fast speeds are standard. No one really has, very, very few people in the developed world have 56K modems anymore. So, you know, what is the difference with some person that's on the dole that can only afford a 56K modem listening that can't really get Truth News because they can't afford it? I mean, you know what I mean?
The difference is that if that person can get the money, they can get Truth News. But if...
Yeah, but that's the same with net neutrality. If
well,
they
no,
can
it's
afford
not, because
to
if,
have
if,
an
if,
internet that allows... a pipe, you know, because there'll be all it's saying. It's like, hey, IINet now have got an option for you to only receive English-speaking sites, so your pipe will be faster because it doesn't have all the burdens of all the other languages.
Well, that's a restriction or a service provided to the user. But as I understand it, the threat here is that because say Truth News is actually housed on a web server based on a data center in California. That's actually quite a large one, by the way, and probably it has so much. So many shared websites on it, like it's got just hundred thousands of domains right on there. Probably that data center would do a deal to make sure that their access to the pipe was fast enough. That, fingers crossed, okay. But
absolutely, otherwise you would move on, and so they're going to push very hard to.
But as the guy was saying, I mean, this could create a price war. And all our prices could go up as you're going to have to, the costs would get, if my data center had to pay a heightened fee to get the quality pipe feed, I would have to pay a heightened fee to get that as well. They would pass the costs on to me. So there would be all this cashing in, all this profiteering on this, what was basically the creation of an artificial distinction, which didn't even need to exist in the first place. And this is what bothers me, is the creation of artificial distinctions. And I think it's a problem.
But there's never been legislation before this, and it's not happened, because people want as free as possible internet.
Yeah, correct. And look, the other side of the coin is that, we're looking here at monopolies, big monopolies, and Google is a monopoly. YouTube was the biggest video sharing site, before Google acquired it. So Google was YouTube was already a kind of a it was becoming a monopoly, but it was a natural monopoly. And there is a difference. See, Google YouTube became a very popular site and it commands the market. It commands the market.
It's like Facebook. It's a natural monopoly.
Yeah, it's a natural monopoly. And I'm not against that. But I am against that they might be able to use the power that they've got through having that monopoly to crush all competition. That's what I'm against.
Yeah, but that only happens when you get government involved. Because if you don't, then you don't have the power to enforce by law your monopoly. And some punk in his little back shed will make some amazing new concept that goes viral and really starts overtaking. He's got a business head, so he starts getting good investors involved, and it explodes. People are greedy. People want to be the next big thing. People want to be Google. And that's how diversity happens in the marketplace. As soon as you start saying, there has to be freedom, there has to be exact equality, then, you watch the internet slow down and get more expensive then, because data centers will be flooded with all this stuff that they, because someone has to pay for the content that's going through the part that, if there's too much bandwidth going through, so they have to invest more money to make more availability for all this illegal content and BitTorrent. Someone has to pay, and it's either going to be everyone at once, which probably will in a free market way anyway, because we want the whole internet. They'll be willing to do that, and it'll be very smooth and minor, because it just scales up as it has in the past, and it probably gets cheaper because as components get cheaper and stuff. But if you start enforcing laws, then then companies have to try and figure a way around it. They have to slow everyone's internet, so they're paying for it through time instead of money, because, and then they expand. I mean, I'm not a huge expert on all this, but this is from a free market standpoint. I just see it as a little bit fascistic
I think there's a tension between centralized control and completely libertarian laissez-faire capitalism, right? There's always been this tension between the two. And I think some level of tension is actually healthy, because I think if you let it go loose in either direction, I think you will end up with another form of totalitarianism.
Have you seen that with the internet? The internet is the most diverse, amazing thing, and it has no regulation. I mean, it's so non-monopolistic, it's not funny.
Yeah, I mean, well, look, we're talking. I was talking about government or central control versus pure free market laissez-faire, those are in a way there's a third player here, and that's the little guy, you and me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's where we've got to always realize that we are the owners of our world.
Well, and this is where I always come back, and it's a very good point, Harold, because I feel like my greatest power in life to make change is with who I spend my money with.
Yeah.
Because they listen. They actually listen.
And the consumer
that supply stuff to me listen. Whereas the governments, they only listen to the big players, the big money, the big people, the big lobby groups.
The average person has got to realize their economic power. And not just their economic power, their political power, their social power. The fact is, we own the world, folks.
Yeah.
And that, I think we can agree on, is something that I think it's developing. I think the awareness, you know, the great political awakening that Zbigniew Brzezinski talked about and seemed to be a little bit worried about.
Yeah.
That is happening. The great political awakening is occurring, but it needs to happen quicker.
Yeah. Look, all I'm saying is whether you enforce it by law or not, I think net neutrality is always going to be there because it's just going to happen like that. It's just always going to be like that. Even if the pipes are all taken up by these sort of some sort of duopoly, someone will come along and create some wireless network and create a new explosion where it just information wants to be free. It doesn't like being tied up, just like Apple and you know how I said before, Apple stopped Skype over 3G network, and now everyone's and because of the closed nature of that phone, people are getting a bit over it.
Yeah, no, it's a really, really interesting point. Look, we're going to have to wind up the show. It's been a really good show tonight.
We've tackled the big stuff here, Harold, I love these sort of conversations. I hate to be dogmatic about it. It's just my view. And look, folks, if you disagree with me or Harold, or you agree with us, leave us a comment on the show notes or tweet us.
Yeah. Look for the information that we told you earlier about ABC, because we're mounting a campaign. And this is what I just said before about the little guy. We're all little guys, and we're all going to fight back like the ants against the grasshoppers in that movie, A Bug's Life.
That's right. You have to realize your power.
Oh, we are vastly powerful. And, I mean, there are so many of us. And I realize that as I start to see the bigger and bigger networks now that I'm getting plugged into. We are just innumerable. And they are small and weak.
They are. Absolutely. Until next week, folks.
Until next week. Yeah, I'm Harold Fenton. Thanks for your company. Good night.